Micro!
Decada!
Micro!
Decada!
Hey there, cultists. Get ready because the Silver Screen podcast is about to explode. Yes, we're in another month into 2024, and it's time for yet another look at a cult classic. And this time we're heading to anime territory, and let's be honest, for a podcast based here in the West, there's really only one thing we could do for this one. And if you somehow managed to stumble in here without noticing the episode title or thumbnail, or didn't get the reference a few seconds ago, we're jumping in the time machine that is our nostalgia trip and setting the dial all the way back to 88 for the seminal classic that is Akira. So, strap yourselves in and get ready as we slap some clowns about a bit. No, I'm not referring to my guests. Speaking of which, I'm DK, your host on these trips of the good, the bad and the ugly, and sometimes all three in one episode. But as usual, I'm not alone. This time around, I have three willing volunteers slash masochists to talk all things two-wheeled telekinesis and tentacles. First up, we've got my semi-regular co-host on these things and host of both Silver Screen Regular Flavor, same great taste, and our recently established Silver Screen Cinema Classic Show. And watch out for his dismissive attitude, as some commenters have put. It's Mr. Mike Wilson.
Yes, that's Mr. Mike to you, punk.
How are you doing this week, fella?
I'm good. I'm only really the master of a pile of rubbish over here. But, you know, we're all really victims of corrupt politicians and capitalists. So what can you do?
Well, there you go. So, same old, same old.
Yeah, much every other week.
Yeah. Next up, he's a regular, pretty much, on the aforementioned Silver Screen show, but believe it or not, 2 years on, this is his first appearance on Cult Classics. It's Toby.
Finally, it's been a long time coming.
It has. Are you looking forward to this one, fella?
Yes, I am. Very much nice. So.
Brilliant. And finally, we've got another Cult Classics virgin. I scoured the length and breadth of the country to find someone who could rightly be considered an anime expert, quotation marks optional, when I realised I'd known someone like that all along. So, audience, allow me to introduce you to the person who helped get me into anime all those years ago, post Akira, by supplying me with tapes of Pat LeBar series on tape. How he got them, I don't know. But regardless, it's Rick.
Hello.
Nice. And how are you?
Me? Yeah, it's I've never done one of these before or anything like this. So, it's going to be interesting.
Oh, so this is not just your first podcast with us, it's your first podcast period?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. I was once interviewed for Radio 1 many, many years ago when we were first doing the first anime convention in Sheffield, which was in the first anime convention in the country, which we held in Sheffield. Back in 1991. This is the first time I've actually done a podcast or anything like that. Yeah.
Oh, nice one. Well, I mean, don't worry. It's fairly straightforward, for pretty foolproof, as you can see from the fact that the rest of us here are doing these things.
Nothing's foolproof if I'm involved.
As is tradition, we like to make our new guests feel relaxed and welcome them by immediately putting them in the spotlight interrogation style and asking them a question to gauge their taste slash psyche slash bet on them. So because you're fairly used to this here podcasting lark, I'm going to come to you first, Toby. If you had to choose just one cult movie to take with you to a desert island, ignoring the whole, you know, play electricity thing, what would you take? What is your all-time favourite cult movie and why? And it can be of any genre.
I mean, I don't know that many cult movies, but I think I already talked about it on the Discord. Mike knows this. Where I asked if this is considered a cult movie, and it's I don't know from which year, like sometime 90s, I think. A Goofy Movie.
Oh!
Wow. I was not expecting that.
Another KO, Mike.
It's a really great movie and really fun, and I really love it. And
I predicted you were going to pick your name. I was sure that's what you would go with.
I mean, is your name just not too new?
No, it's not a cult movie. I mean, it's my
yeah. Okay, I guess. But I was more thinking of older stuff.
No, it's
so...
a good movie. That's fine.
Mike, I mean, Mike's just trying to influence you.
Your name is amazing as well.
I've not seen either. So Goofy Movie is a pretty good one, is it?
It is. It's really funny. It's really heartful. It has everything you want. It has musical numbers. It's Disney fun from, now I googled, 1995. Only 78 minutes, so a quickie. So, yeah.
Oh, I might get that one a go later. Nice one.
I remember something hearing about a Goofy Movie about it was actually Don Bluth was originally supposed to be doing the animation for it, and he had a bit of a falling out with Disney. So they moved over to France and used some French production companies to make it, if I remember.
I'm going to come to you now with the same question, Rick. What's your favourite cult movie and why?
Crikey. Just trying to narrow down, all the things I've ever watched and all the daft, stupid, ridiculous films I've watched, that are either brilliant or terrible, and I still like them. But I'm probably going to stick with an anime one, and that's Royal Space Force, Wings of Honeymias, which was where the Gainax, the company that went on to make things like Neon Genesis Evangelion and Secret of Blue Water and stuff like that, it was the film that they were founded to make by Bandai. So I'll probably go with that. Yeah.
Nice one. So... a couple of nice choices there. And, I think we both kind of sort of nailed it there, Mike.
Well, I did terribly. I don't know about you.
No, but they were still kind of unknowns. It's nothing that
I didn't
before.
Say that for Toby, remember? I tripled down on, it's definitely going to be your name, and if it's not, it's going to be a Miyazaki film, and then he surprises me with a Disney film out of nowhere, this guy.
Yeah. So, kiss goodbye to your bonus points, mate.
Exactly, yeah.
So, if you're wondering what any of this has to do with today's movie, then, quite right too. So without further ado, we'll get straight into it, and please forgive us going forward for, especially me, for any mispronunciation of names. Can't even say mispronunciation. Akira is a 1988 Japanese cyberpunk anime movie written and directed by, get ready to hear it, Katsuhiro Otomo.
Yep.
Awesome. Based on Otomo's 1982 manga of the same name, it tells the story of Shotaro Kaneda, the leader of a biker gang whose childhood friend Tetsuo Shima acquires telekinetic abilities after a motorcycle accident in the futuristic megalopolis of Neo Tokyo and the events that spring from that fateful event. While most of the character designs and settings were adapted from the manga, the plot differs considerably and does not include much of the last half of said manga, which continued publication for 2 years after the film's release. It originally premiered on July 16th, 1988 in Japan, and was released in the US the following year, despite such luminaries as Steven Spielberg and George Lucas claiming it would be completely unmarketable to Western audiences. In the UK, it set off a little bit of a renaissance of interest in the Japanese animation field and led to the release of several notable anime series and movies shortly after. Over the years, it's garnered an international cult following, and both the movie and the manga it is based on are still extremely popular. Now, it's been cited as a masterpiece and a landmark in Japanese animation, and is widely regarded by audiences and critics as one of the greatest and most iconic anime films ever made. And it's been hugely influential, both in paving the way for the growth of anime in the Western world and on popular culture in general, with said influences still resonating into the present day. It's also, alongside Watership Down and The Fantastic Mr. Fox, one of the few animated features adopted into the Criterion Collection. And as with pretty much everything we look at here on Cult Classics, Akira can currently be found on multiple streaming platforms, dependent on your location, as well as in physical formats up to and including 4K. Now, this one was an out-of-the-blue discovery for me. It first came onto my radar as part of a 1989 documentary in the UK, The Day Comics Grew Up, which was a look at how so-called mature graphic novel titles such as Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns were leading the vanguard, as it were, of adult storytelling in what at that point was still viewed by the public at large as a childish medium. Now, the piece featured clips from Akira, and I honestly loved the look of it. However, the chance of it coming to cinemas in the UK, especially where I lived, were virtually non-existent at that point, and without the internet, there was no way of tracking something like this down, so I kind of forgot about it. Then, a couple of years later, I was on holiday with my girlfriend at the time and a few friends, and we visited a local comic book shop on the way back from Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Thunderbooks, I believed it was called.
Oh, Thunderbooks.
Yeah. It's no longer there. It's a shame. And as we approached, I could see that the movie was given front and centre in one of the window displays. I went straight in, picked up a copy on VHS. I mean, you know, no such thing as DVDs back then. And proceeded to spend the journey home reading and rereading the back cover of this thing, much to my girlfriend's chagrin. As soon as I got home, the thing went straight on the player and I was blown away, really. So, what were your first memories of this one? Was it something you're around for on its release, or was it a more recent thing? I'm going to come to you first on this one, Rick. I know you're an anime lover, but am I right? You were working in the Space Center, the comic book shop yourself at the time. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, my sort of like love of anime and manga goes back to being a little kid. You know, when I first watched Marine Boy. Hence my icon, back in sort of 1972. So I've always been a fan of anime and manga and stuff from sort of then on. But Akira came onto my sort of radar in the sort of like late 80s. There was at the time several companies, including Marvel through their Epic publication line, looking at producing manga series translated into English for Western audiences. First Comics were already doing some, and a couple of other companies like Eclipse were experimenting as well with like another company called Viz, who were quite small at the time, and Dark Horse Comics were sort of looking at doing a few as well, and then Marvel announced that they'd secured the rights to release Akira. So it was sort of like, yeah, around that sort of time, probably a little bit later on, that it actually got off the ground. But the actual, I used to go to London sometimes and see a couple of Japanese bookshops and visit them, buy manga, buy magazines on anime. And there were adverts sort of like 88, 89, sort of like for Akira being released. So that was where I first noticed the actual film version that was coming out. And again, like yourself, never thought that we'd ever actually see it released in a format that we could watch in the West, sort of thing, you know. There was a lot of fandom, anime fans, sort of like a fandom network, who would, by hook or by crook, get hold of copies of anime on video cassette. And they'd trade them with friends and other people for other anime on video cassette, and everything would be swapped backwards and forwards. And there was a chance that Akira might turn up like that one day, but we didn't know. So it could be, you know, from at that point of view, it could be a couple of years or it could be 10 years before we saw it. And of course, it never happened like that. It changed. Yeah, when it came out, everybody became aware of it, because it was quite a phenomenal success, not just in Japan, but in the West as well. You know, it did start off quite slowly, but it built up quite a cult following fairly quickly, I think, anyway. I mean, I remember we did the Anime Day convention back in 91, and we actually had a US video cassette version of it to show in one of our screening rooms. So there were a lot of people who came along to that day, to that one day event, just to watch Akira. So, you know, and I don't think anybody went home disappointed, to be fair. I didn't.
Was that screening room the first time that you'd seen it, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was quite, you know, quite exceptional. Sort of like, yeah, I mean, the animation quality, even then, even if you compare it to work that comes out now or recently, I think it still holds up, you know, even though it's, you know, what, nearly 35, 40 years old getting on to. So, yeah. You know, it's, yeah, it's, I think, you know, the people who made it put a lot of hard work in it, you know, into it, into making it as good as they could. So, yeah, no, I mean, I was aware of it, but it, again, that sort of period of time, I didn't think I'd probably ever see it. I mean, I own two or three versions of it now, so, you know, on different formats and stuff. So, yeah, it's a completely different world we live in. You never know what the future holds.
Exactly. What about you, am I right, Toby? You only saw this, was it yesterday for the first time?
Yeah, like 20 hours ago. I don't know, 21. Wow.
But yeah.
I mean, I always have a problem with older stuff that I'm so busy keeping up with everything new that I just never find time to watch older stuff. It's exhausting. Way too much stuff to watch. Help.
Had it been on your radar before? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I knew of it, of course.
Cool. Cool. And what about you, Mike? What are your memories of this one?
Well, you'll have probably heard me a few times saying that a few of the, you know, the more classic well-known films were because I did film studies at university. And this one's actually even earlier than that. This was media studies in high school. We were shown this in what must have been, I'm guessing, the mid to late 90s. There was our media studies teacher decided we were going to do a section on animation, specifically like the burgeoning or re-emerging of Japanese anime. And so we were shown Akira and Ghost in the Shell, which I was like, obviously mind-blowing at the time. I was probably only about 15, 16 and, you know, fairly sheltered living in the northeast of England. So this was my exposure to anime and was completely just like, wow, this is amazing. And then it did come up again. Both of those actually did come up again during the film course when we got to actually doing animation at university. And I learned a bit more about the actual technical side of things and the ins and outs of it. So I'd kind of seen it twice for work reasons, shall we say, and just loved it, I think, both times. And so when I was shopping one day, just randomly for stuff that I knew was, I think it was a list of stuff that we had that we were covering for the film course, and it was on the list. And I was like, well, that's a very excuse to look on the HMV sale or whatever and see how much it is. So I've had it on Blu-ray ever since then. And yeah, just waiting for an opportunity to, or a chance to watch and talk about it with people. Because I have had conversations with friends of mine who are really into like more modern anime and things like that, who haven't seen it. And I'm like, you've got to watch Akira. I'm going to come over sometime. I'm going to bring Akira. It just weirdly never happened. So this is, I think, my first opportunity to talk about it with people.
Fair enough. Yeah. So, I guess this question is primarily for you, Mike, and you, Rick. You came to this quite early on in its release over here. Is it a regular rewatch, or is it one of those things that you rarely put on and you just, you know, you recognise it as a classic?
Well, for me, I mean, it's a while since I actually have actually watched it. I was going to watch it again sort of in the last couple of weeks, but I actually went to watch Boy and the Heron last week in the cinema. It was doing a rerun after the Oscar win, so I went and watched that instead. So, you know, so I do try and keep up with some newer stuff, but, I mean, it's like a comfy pair of slippers or something like that. I know it's always there. I mean, it's probably a couple of years since I last watched it. I do go back and rewatch some stuff occasionally, some things more than others. But I do still have quite a fondness for it. You know, it was quite radical, even for a sort of an example, not just of anime, for me anyway, but of any sort of like filmic sort of media. Just knowing that I own versions of it and I can just pick it off the shelf and watch it when I want to, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Cool. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, weirdly, not as much as I probably should or could have done, because, like I said, it's one that I'd seen a couple of times under the kind of academic impetus. So I had seen it those two times and then bought it with every intention of watching it. And a bit like Toby, I just never get around to a lot of these things that I've bought. And so, yeah, there's multiple times when I've been like, oh, I'm going to watch Akira this day, and it just hasn't happened for whatever reason. So I think the time that I watched it earlier this week for the recording was maybe the third or fourth at a push time I've ever seen it. And every time I do watch it, I'm like, I should watch this more often, but I just seemingly don't for whatever reason. So, yeah, I can't say. It's not as regular as it should be, but I still am always impressed by it, and I do recognize all of the importance of it, you know?
Yeah, any of you guys, have your impressions changed since your initial viewing? I mean, the first time I watched this was on the VHS cassette, and it wasn't until this time that I realised that I'd been watching that redone dub. So yeah. Even though it was kind of a better dub, it kind of wrong-footed me, as it were, because I kept expecting different lines, different voices. But other than that, I mean, I don't think that the movie's lost any of its kind of impact. I'm just wondering if any of you, and I'm not trying to leave you out here, Toby. I'm just wondering if anybody's impression has changed of it since their initial viewing.
I can feel this one because mine has actually, because I remember the very first time that I saw it. I was really impressed with all of it, and then for whatever reason, I just got really grossed and weirded out by the ending, and just thought it was that was like lodged in my brain. You know exactly what I mean—the weird kind of mutating dude thing. But my memory going away from it that first time was that took up way more of the film, because I was like, "Oh, that was great," until that kind of last, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes when it got really weird, and then after the sort of second and third time, I was like, that's literally maybe the last 10 minutes. Yeah. I don't know where my impression was that was so long of the film, yeah?
Do you know something? I had exactly the same. Watching it this time, I seem to recall that section with the mutated Tetsuo being a lot longer than it was in reality.
It hasn't really sort of like changed my view of it or anything, but I do think that... if I watched it again, I mean, you know, I might get an opportunity to watch it next couple of weeks, that I will probably, you know, pay maybe a little bit more attention to other details.
Yeah.
And everything. I've always sort of like, you know, if you watch it, if you spend like, you know, two or three watchings going through it, just looking at all the backgrounds, fantastically painted, all the colours that they use, like, you know, it's just superb, but you could just do that, and never watch the actual. You never watch the film because you just stood in the backgrounds all the time, the background like layouts and everything. So you know, I think it's difficult to do on a run through where you spend all that time just looking at one thing in particular or one sequence. Probably best to watch the whole first, I think.
Yeah. Have any of you guys actually read the manga before seeing the movie, or after seeing the movie, for that matter?
Yeah, I was collecting them. I worked in a comic shop. I couldn't not buy comics. So, yeah, I mean, I've got the full run of the manga series. I mean, the manga series was paused for a while the film was being made, because Otomo couldn't draw it and direct the film at the same time. That's why there was a gap of a few years between before the last section of the actual manga series came out, because he was actually making and promoting the film at the time, you know. So, and I think he went on to do Rurouni Zed sort of straight after. So I think there was quite a chunk of a delay before he actually finished the comic series, the manga series.
How much does it differ?
Quite a bit, actually. The ending of the anime seems to lead on to something that may happen. There's more sort of potential events happening, whereas in the manga series, they actually take one of the potential ideas and run with it further. I don't want to say anything in case anybody wants to like read it, but up to a point, the main sort of plots and themes within the anime and the manga series are the same. Yeah, and even right through to the end of the actual manga series, the themes, and I think the sort of like the underlying ideas are still there. They've not really changed much. It's just that but Tomo decided that if you were watching the film and you were reading the manga, you'd want a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a Game of Thrones. We'll put it like that.
Weirdly enough, I think I found when I was researching it that it's that kind of similarities to one of the next classical recordings I'm going to do, because I'm covering 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
And you know that like film came out while they were still writing the book, and then the book comes out and it's got a completely different ending. So it's bizarrely comparable to that, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, no, I agree. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, apparently Otomo, he didn't want to adapt the series outside of the manga. he did become very intrigued when the offer to develop his work for the screen was put before him. And he only agreed to it, though, on the grounds he retained creative control after a bad experience previously.
No, I can understand that. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the manga series was quite a phenomenon as well. So I think that's why they... you know, they sort of relented, the production companies relented and allowed him to make it as he wanted it to be made.
Yeah.
So that he could maintain, you know, the integrity that he wanted to keep on it. So, you know, that makes sense to me. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how do you think I'll come to you first on this one, Mike. I mean, how do you think the writing is on this piece?
It's good. I mean, I did want to clarify for any of the audience who are confused by our intro and stuff, because when you were talking about overriding things that stick in your brain, one of the other ones is just immediately coming after that first viewing, me and a bunch of, you know, similar 15, 16-year-old friends just wandering around the playground screaming, Tetsuo! Kaneda! Because all we could remember was them just screaming each other's names at each other for large swaths of the movie. And then walking out going, I didn't catch that guy's name. Tetsuo, was it? Yeah, I mean, writing-wise, it's really cleverer than I gave it initial credit for, because the first time I watched it, I was just like, ooh, cool bike. Ooh, iconic slide visuals and stuff. And watching it back now, I'm like, there are so many really deeper philosophical themes at play if you want to see them. You don't have to. You can appreciate it on the level of just like, ooh, this looks shiny and fun and cool, and there's a lot of action and gore and violence and then a giant mutant at the end of it. What more do you want? But yeah, there's also some really cool, like I said, explorations of things like the nature of capitalism and the corruption at the heart of the government. You know, nature of religion and false messiahs and the way they can be manipulated, and just all kinds of things about destiny and fate. And then, like I said, weirdly enough, bringing it back again to 2001 A Space Odyssey, because the ending is also remarkably similar, which is just very much you're going to ascend to a whole new plane and find your destiny in other places if you want to read it that way. If not, of course, he's just dead. So you don't need to worry about it. But yeah, there's a lot going on, I think, under the surface of this one.
Yeah. What about you, Rick?
Well, I agree, actually. There is a lot of sort of like other themes, like I say, going on in it that are, you know, that are picked up from the manga series, and you know, he's taking them and run with them. I think that the idea that there is more going on in them than you realise, it's definitely true. You know, they're, you can always, I mean, it's like anything else, I suppose, any kind of film, you can read more into it than maybe is actually there, but you know, it's. I think there's a lot that can be read into it because it is there.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot in this. What, you know, as we said, Toby, you came to this relatively recently. So, what's your take on the writing of this? What did you start getting from this one?
I really appreciated how straightforward it is most of the time, because I've seen so many cyberpunk sci-fi stuff that just get into so messy territory. I mean, most of it was serious, so. It's a movie, it's a little bit different, but still, it can go into very messy territory quickly, where it's like, oh, everything is ending, 10-20 twists and all of this. And it does get a little bit into that in the end, but for the most part, it's quite straightforward, I think, the writing. And that was really surprising to me and really fun to watch that it's not from the get-go, I don't know what's going on. Everything is messy.
I mean, you said it had been on your radar for quite some time before you got around to watching it. Was it? Did it live up to your expectations? Was it what you expected when you finally saw it?
I mean, the problem with watching something as iconic and influential as this way later is that it influenced so much that most of the stuff that's original here is already stuff that I'm familiar with because it's influenced down over and over again. So I didn't really have this effect of, oh my God, what is this? Completely new, never seen before. But it's really cool to see where a lot of stuff started.
Yeah. Cool. I remember you saying, Mike, you've got quite a few notes with regards to this. Is there anything you want to bring up with, you know, else with the writing?
Yeah, well, in terms of writing, like I said, it was more that I was trying to identify some things that were, like I said, relevant that I maybe didn't pick up on at first, and things that just I wanted to note that the film was about. And like, obviously, it stands to reason that the most blatant one is that it's talking about kind of teen culture. And, you know, that you've always got that over-exaggerated view of, oh, if teens start ruling society, there's going to be bike gangs and fights every night and all the rest of it. And they're all going to be taking these capsules of drugs. And yeah, it's over the top, but at the same time, that's cyberpunk neo-noir, isn't it, really? I mean, that is their entire basis. So I kind of appreciated it on that historical level, because like I said, you look at, what was it, late 80s, early 90s, when this was a growing, I think, thing again. You know, we'd looked at films where that was the case in the 50s, and this was the case again now, where the younger generation were starting to ask questions, I think, that the older generation weren't overly happy about. So there's a bit of that, I think, in here. I've kind of mentioned, I think, most of the other stuff, like the idea of, obviously, Akira and Tetsuo are kind of an implication of what two different sides can do with power, with Tetsuo being the kind of power corrupts, absolutely, and Akira being, you know, the people in authority don't want their power challenged, so they're trying to, I guess, you know, keep that under wraps.
Yeah. It is kind of, you know, mirrored in the goings on behind the scenes with the general and the council. You know, you've got two kind of, I'm not going to say tribes, but you've got two opposing viewpoints that are each vying for power.
Yeah, and even to a degree, the fight between, as it gets to be worse and worse, the fight between the colonel character and the doctor, which is sort of the argument of, you know, science versus, I don't know what you would call it, like military power, and science being abused by this guy who's like, no, science is, but at all means justifies everything. This military guy that's just like, no, we need to contain anything that's not ordered. And so, yeah, even towards the end of the film with those two clashing, I was like, oh, it's another theme they've introduced here on top of everything else, you know?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot to unpack with this one. And, you know, I think Otomo did right in saying that he wanted creative control over it, because I think putting this in the hands of someone else, someone that didn't write this, I think you're going down a path there where the message is kind of going to start to get lost. And it does come through in the direction. I mean, with something like this, your direction and your animation, they kind of blend into one. And I mean, at the time, it was one of the most expensive animated films ever made. I think it was like something like $10 million US, and then they threw another $1 million at it for the 2001 redub. And I mean, so much of this looks gorgeous. So, I mean, even small little things like the bike trails, the start with the lights.
I was just going to say, that was one thing that the teacher that first showed us this back in high school was absolutely obsessed with, this concept that like animation never really tried to mimic some of the flaws of live action, and this actually animates lens flares that don't exist, obviously, because it's animated, and yet you've got lens flares when the bikes are going at such speeds, like you said, the trails of the bikes coming off, and it's realistic to a hyper level that you didn't need to do because it's animated. You can get rid of that quote unquote flaw, but they wanted it to make it look like it was being filmed for real. And so that level of detail is just gorgeous, outstanding.
Attention to detail is psychotic, isn't it? It really is. There's sort of like, there's a different level of will going on there, making it that sort of like detailed and heavy. you know, on you know, yeah, the attention to detail, it would drive some people crazy, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I found while I was doing the research, the movie consists of 2,212 shots and 160,000 single pictures. There were 2 to 3 times more shots than usual, using 327 different colours, which was a record in animation, 50 of which were exclusively created for the film. And the reason is that most of the movie takes place at night, which is, you know, a setting that's traditionally avoided by animators because of the increased colour requirements. And, yeah, they only, like, really use CG to plot the paths of falling objects. And I believe it was where the Doctor is viewing the wave pattern.
Yeah.
Other than that, I mean, it was used for, like, tweaking lighting and lens flares, but other than that, it was, you know, entirely hand-drawn. And
yeah,
I think it works. I'm a big proponent of hand-drawn animation over CG, and I think this is one of the films that really sells it for me.
I do have a funny story. I don't know if you've actually got it in your notes, so hopefully I'm not stepping on your toes, about the level of detail that was expected of the animators. Did you read about the thing that was when they're looking at a clipboard in one particular scene?
I've got the one at the 38 minutes into the film. When he's listening to the doctor's assessment, there's a caution note on the doctor's equipment which features English text beneath it, and when transcribed with Japanese characters, the text roughly translates as follows: "Why do I even have to draw this part? Give me a break, jeez."
Yeah, very passive aggressive message from the animators.
Yeah, I love that kind of thing. But
I do too.
Yeah, but I mean, it shines through in the quality of the animation, and there are certain sections that, you know, if you, I guess for someone like you, Toby, it's kind of old hat after watching so many animes over the years. But you know, where Kay shoots the gun and blows the cops guy's face off. Or, you know, the section where Tetsu is having that kind of anxiety attack, as it were, and he imagines his guts falling out onto the street. Yeah. I think they're kind of gross, but they're also kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can see that. Yeah. There's, it's down to, like, you know, we need to put this level of detail in, isn't it?
I mean, there are certain sections of this that I just absolutely adore. One of them is the part where Canada and Kay are on that skiff, and the elevator opens up onto those two guards, and it's just floating there, and like, kind of the air, it's showing the air currents around, and I just think it looks absolutely beautiful, absolutely stunning. And that's, you know, we've not even mentioned, say, the first 20 minutes, where I think is where it's what grabbed most people's imagination with, you know, the bikers.
I think you could watch that on its own as like a mini 20-minute movie, and it's like 5 out of 5, amazing, brilliant, don't need anything else, just, you know, just wowed by that. But yeah, as part of the greater thing that this is, it's even better.
Yeah. It does kind of prime you for the rest of the movie. And I'll be completely honest, when I first saw it way back then, the bike section was my favourite, because I, you know.
Oh yeah. I mean, it still is with me, I think, yeah.
It's really weird, actually. There's a company out there, Ebel, I believe it's called, that have actually put Canada's bike into production.
Oh, wow.
And I think I've seen something about that.
I think they've got a thing on Instagram. I'll try and put the link in the description. But they've been building it, and it actually does. It is roadworthy. And then they did a promo shoot for it, I think a couple of weeks ago, where they put it, you know, on a stage and got this female model draped all over it. And I would say 99% of the comments were just, get the model out of the shot. We just want to see the bike. Well, when you look on how that section alone has influenced, you know, animation going forward, I mean, that bike scene, it's been homaged in Teen Titans, Clone Wars, Samurai Jack, Batman the Animated Series, Ninja Turtles, Adventure Time, Simpsons, even Pokemon.
Kira Slider's turned up in 1,000 places. It's like the Wilhelm scream at this point. You can just point to it when it happens and cheer it up.
Yeah, it really is. It's even now. I know we've reiterated this several times, but it's just stunning to look at. And when you look at this, Mike, I mean, you were there for the episode last year when we were looking at Transformers the movie, and I'm not going to diss the animation in that. It's serviceable. But when you look at this, which came just 2 years later, it's just a completely different kettle of fish.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we've pointed out a few of the flaws in... As much as we enjoy Transformers the movie, there's a lot of animation errors and characters turning up and disappearing and stuff, whereas the level of attention to detail in this, you can't imagine they would have got away with that kind of crap.
Oh, God, no. So, yeah, I mean, is there any kind of standouts with regards to the direction or the animation for you guys on this?
Little things like the beads of sweat on characters that somebody bothered to animate, or when Canada's riding the bike, the way that it pulses slightly at the front as if it's an actual, like, working engine, which, again, attention to detail you didn't need, but it's so... just adds an extra depth to it.
Those little sparks that come off the wheel when it's sort of charging up, isn't it? Because it's all electromagnetic. Yeah, it's nice, that.
even mundane things like when Tetsuo's in the bed and he drops the glass and the glass rolls on the floor and leaves that little trail of liquid.
I can't remember where it is, but the scene when they're in, like, the cold area and they've actually bothered animating, like, the condensation of the cold breath, and I'm just like, well, that is, again, above and beyond, man.
Yeah. What about you, Toby? Anything stand out for you with regards to the animation in this?
I mean, can there be really a standout if, like, everything is amazing? Like, I'm trying to think one thing that's, like, this is above the rest, and, like, I mean, the... all the details, but also the intro scene is really, really great. It's so great animated. The quality, I think you could easily release today. Like, there are some technical stuff that's obviously, we are a couple years away from this already, but just the quality of it, I think you could see today. I think the animation quality you could see today. Totally.
Yeah, definitely. Have any of you guys got any more kind of notes on the animation before we move on to the next bit?
A little more muted colors. I think that would be a little bit controversial today, I think, because nowadays animation is more, well, stronger colors, more in a way.
Like a little more in your face.
Yeah.
I think that's just because you're not used to nighttime filming kind of thing, though.
Maybe, but I still think... it would definitely go against the trend today. But I think you could release it as it is today, and while it would be going against the trend, I think people would still say it looks amazing.
Yeah. Well, I read while I was looking, even though, you know, it is a common practice, and it's been a common practice in the West with regards to animation, this was the first animated movie in Japan where the dialogue was recorded first and then the animation built around it. I mean, with regards to the English dub, obviously it were originally released in the US by Streamline Pictures in 90, and then Pioneer, when they got the license, they spent that $1 million in restoring it, as well as recording, that more accurate English dub. That Streamline dub was apparently unavailable for 12 years until Funimation reinstated it for their 25th anniversary edition. That were back in Blu-ray combo, and it were released in 2013. But I know you had some notes on this with regards to the dub, Mike.
Well, not really, just that I was looking into which versions it is, and I couldn't tell you which ones I'd watched previously, but my Blu-ray auto played, and so I paused it about 10 minutes in to see which version it was, and after looking it up, found out it was the 2001 version, which apparently is the recommended sort of superior one. Which I love the voice actors in that, and not just because a solid, like, 50% of them are all veterans of Power Rangers, which I'm a huge fan of, as you know. So, the voice of Canada is Johnny Yong Bosch, who you may know as Adam, the second original Black Power Ranger, the Ranger in the movie and everything. And he's kind of, when he left that show, he went on to a career doing anime sort of English dub voiceovers, and he's really bloody good. So I was appreciating his performance just as a voice actor in this, But yeah, I mean, other than him, the only real people that I made notice of were, I looked up to see who voiced Kyoko, because I thought she was really impressive, and it's an actress called Sandy Fox, which is the coolest name. Sounds like a porn name, and probably is. I don't know her. And yeah, Simon Prescott, I do know, because he voiced Master Vile in Power Rangers, but he's got a really distinctive voice. I thought he was really good. He played the Doctor in this as well. So yeah, but like everybody was good. It was just those were the standouts that I was like, I must look up who actually did those voices in this version.
Yeah. I think there's one, what's her name? Barbara Goodson. She was the only actress in this that was in both the Streamline dub and the Pioneer dub.
Do you know what Barbara Goodson's most famous for?
I don't.
She is the English voice of Rita Repulsa from Power Rangers.
Oh, well, it brings up an interesting question. I mean, normally it kind of falls into two camps when you know, Westerners are watching anime. And a lot of people do not like going for the dub. They always prefer the subtitled version. I'm just wondering, when it comes to this, do you have any preference? And I'll come to you first, Toby. I mean, you know, what do you prefer with it when it comes to anime itself? Do you prefer the original Japanese, or do you go for dubs?
I mean, my opinion is probably not very important to me, because I don't watch English dubs. No.
Yeah.
Either I watch the sub or the German dub, because why would I watch an English dub?
It wasn't a specific English language, but I mean, when it comes to watching anime yourself, do you go for the dub version, you know, or do you go for the subbed?
I mean, I don't mind either. I think if both are available, I go for the dub version because it's easier, but if there isn't, then I don't care.
That's fair enough. What about... Go on, I'll ask you, Rick, because you're a connoisseur of all this stuff.
I've been called certain things, but I've never been called a connoisseur.
I've been there in the shop, mate.
Yeah, exactly. I've been called plenty. I prefer the subtitled version, but that's just because I'm a nerdy, geeky fanboy. I did study Japanese for a few years at night school. And in Sheffield, so I was picking up on the words that were being spoken, and I was comparing to the subtitles as I was watching them and everything. I mean, yeah, up until a certain point, and occasionally even now, you get some dubbed versions of Japanese films and anime, and the dubbing isn't particularly great. Yeah, there are some really, really suspect, sort of like dodgy. Dubbed versions of like Japanese cartoons and of anime. There's a Robotech one, which was done many, many years ago. I mean, it was a Macross adaptation of one of the Macross movies, and it was called Clash of the Bionoids. And the dubbing is appalling. Yeah, they changed loads of the script. And just they must have just asked people to come in off the street for a tenner or something like that to do the work. It is terrible. Yeah, I mean, the actual animated version of Macross and a couple of other cartoons were sort of amalgamated together to make one long animated series for syndication, which they called under the banner of Robotech. And the dubbing on that is far superior. Because the people who were making it, the guy went on to form Streamline Pictures, one of the guys, was actually, he actually gave us stuff. He actually cared about the work, the stuff he was producing, what they were working on. So I think that there can be, there can be very good dubs out there, but there can also be some quite terrible ones. That said, I have also watched some, one of the earlier Akira adaptations, that was made, and the subtitles are not just a bit inaccurate, but they're also in the middle of the actual the film. They actually appear on the film rather than, say, in the box underneath in the letterbox format. So that any of the sequences where there's a lot of white light, which happens often, you can't see the subtitles at all because they're white. They just disappear. So you have no idea what's actually being said or what's going on.
Genius.
It's like, what were you thinking? What were you doing? You had one job.
The dialogue was just interrupted by how awestruck they were.
Yeah.
What, when it comes to Akira, what do you personally prefer? Do you prefer the dub version or the sub version? And if it is the dub version, do you have any preference as to the original Streamline one or the Pioneer one at 2001?
For me, I mean, I don't mind. They're both all right. They're both pretty good. So yeah, I'm quite happy to watch either of those. But I would probably just watch the subtitled version because that's the one I'm most familiar with.
Fair enough. What about you, Mike?
I'm just like that.
I don't have a preference. I used to be quite snobbish about, like, no, you must always watch any Japanese films with subtitles. And then it was just kind of, I forget what it was I was watching, and I think it was somebody I respect, some kind of director or something, that was just like, if you want to watch a dubbed version, just watch a dubbed version. Don't feel ashamed of it. You still, you know, if it exposes you to the movie, just do it. And so I got less kind of up my own ass, as it were, about that after that. So I've seen Kira both, and I will say, like, I don't have a preference. I think both are good. I do think, having seen both dubs, that the newer dub is definitely the superior to the original one, which is very kind of workaday almost, like you said. It's like they're in there to do a job. They're not really voice actors as such, so much as just translators. And I can tell there's more of a performance going on in the newer version. Mind you, I haven't seen, because to Rick's point, I know that some of the translations in the initial subtitled version are really bad, but supposedly one of the things they did when they re-released in 2001 was to do new translations as well. So the subtitles have supposedly improved, but I haven't seen that, so I can't comment. I'd like to. I might give that a go next, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sticking on the on the audio, I've got a comment on the soundtrack, and again, you'll have to correct me because I know for a fact I'm going to get this mispronounced here, Rick. Gaino Yamashimogumi, who did the soundtrack for this, I think it's absolutely fantastic. I don't know what you guys think to this. Apparently, the music was completed before any of the composers saw a frame or read the script, so the music had to be edited down to fit some scenes. And the one that stands out in my mind, there's a beautiful little track on the soundtrack called Winds Over Neo Tokyo. I think it's amazing. It's really haunting. And they use it in the movie, and I believe they only use it once, where Tetsuo first escapes, and he's sat with Kaori, and they're having that little conversation, and he throws the can down onto the pipes, and the scene just changes, and they cut that track short. And it's such a crime to me, because I think it's just one of the all-time great music tracks from a score. So I just wondered what you guys thought to the soundtrack for this one.
Yeah, I really like it. There was one or two tracks that appeared multiple times throughout the movie, and the first times they appear, they feel a little bit out of place, and I was like, I don't know about that. But they appear more often, and at some point later, I mean, I don't know what scene it was, they make more sense, and then you look back at where the other times it's been used, and you're like, oh, I get it now. Now I get why this thing was used there, because it's the beginning of a character development that was not very apparent at that moment where the soundtrack was first used, but later on it became much clearer, and I really liked that looking back. But first time watching, I was just in the beginning at some stuff, I was like, this feels very loud for this scene and very in your face.
Yeah. What about you, Mike?
I really love it. I mean, being something of an otaku, I obviously appreciated the use of things like the Japanese No music at the start, but the way that that's mixed beautifully with like Indonesian music to give you this kind of weird, I guess, ethereal quality. I think that's more during like the bike chase and everything at the very start, like I said, because that's like its own mini movie to me almost. I think it's beautiful because it really captures this eerie sense of familiar but far enough in the future that it's a little bit weird and distant as well. And other than that, like it's influential throughout the film, the tracks you can kind of, there's bits that have been sampled in hip-hop and everything that you recognize as you go, but my personal highlights are as you get towards the end of the film and it just all becomes like a choir and like chants almost, and you get the sort of songs that are chanting like Akira, Akira, Akira.
Yeah.
And yeah, just all of that, it's just haunting, and it adds so much more, I think, to those end scenes, which is rare. Like if you notice the music, usually it's because it's bad as opposed to noticing it in a way that like, wow, this is enhancing, which I think this soundtrack does, and I'd love to own it at some point.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, like, you know, like the sort of like, it's almost like Kodo drumming, isn't it, in the sequences and at the beginning when the bike sequence is happening, you know. It's just, I mean, it's not like any other soundtrack, really. You know, I mean, it's been imitated. I think I remember Pop Will Eat Itself sampled some of the breathing sequences and some of the music and some of the Kodo music drumming on it on one of their old tracks. So, you know, it's, it influences everybody everywhere. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of the influences, I mean, obviously, this thing's got quite a legacy to it, and it's influenced so many things over the years since it's released. You know, we've already talked about how it's, you know, been inducted into the Criterion Collection. As far as a legacy goes, this is a big one. But for years now, they've been talking about doing a live action adaptation. It's been bandied around for as long as I remember, and the most recent name attached was Taika Waititi. I just wondered what you guys thought to this.
I don't like, from what Taika Waititi has done so far, I'm like, this does not fit. Where's the sense? Like I'm not saying he can't do a good job, but just seeing what he, like the last few movies he did, I don't know about this earlier stuff, I'm like, where? How does this make sense? It's so different from the four movies, Jojo Rabbit, Next Go Wins, or What We Do in the Shadows.
It's
so different. I'm like, I don't know, how is this supposed to work out?
I agree. I agree with Toby there. It's a good director at doing the things he likes doing, but I don't think he would be a good fit for this. But I'm not sure who I'd select.
It's too serious for me. You have to approach it earnestly without being too kind of, you know, highfalutin about it. But Taika Waititi, as far as I can see, doesn't really have that reverence. And all my thoughts on a potential remake are in my conclusion, so I won't get into that. But I will say, if Taika Waititi is interested in doing a remake, do Flash Gordon, buddy. It's right there for you.
I just wanted to stay away from Time Bandits, to be honest. I don't care what he does, as long as he keeps away from that. So, yeah, I mean, is there anything with regards to the film that you don't think that we've brought up that you think warrants attention before we move on?
Well, I've got a big few things if you wanted to...
Yeah, go for it, mate.
Well, just a couple of things that I'd noticed in terms of the... when we're talking about attention to detail, I don't know if you noticed on the early on when they go into the bar, there's band logos on the jukebox and they're actual bands. I recognize Cream.
Yeah,
I know there's a couple more, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I do know Cream's one of them. I think isn't Led Zeppelin one of them?
Possibly, but I couldn't really. It went by that quick and I didn't bother pausing, but I was like, I definitely recognize Cream on there. And I mean, come on, that's just so cool. I'm animating actual stuff. And a lot of the graffiti that they bothered to animate in Japanese and English, which is just like, the level of detail is insane.
Yeah. As usual, find out what our audience thinks of this one in a moment. But before, I've got to ask, what is it about this that particularly grips you? Is an aspect that just gives you the shivers, and it can be anything from a technical aspect to that emotional connection, you know, just what is it, if anything, that does it for you? And I'm going to come to you first on this one, Mike. I know you've got a couple of things for this.
Just like I said, it's a few genres meshing that I love. Like, you know, I love Japanese film, mainly horror, but you know, the occasional anime, and I love like Japanese culture, and I'm obsessed with sci-fi, with futurism, neo-noir and that kind of thing, so, and cyberpunk, so that kind of meshes all of those things together that I love. But just like I said, the level of attention to detail, just daft things like when Tetsuo flies up into space and there's actually no sound because why would there be? And it's one of the first films I think to have gotten that right. Not that I mind if, you know, you can suspend disbelief in the sci-fi films, but it's just such an added extra touch that I loved. And I do have a little sort of behind the scenes-ish type story about how weirdly prophetic the film may have been, if you don't mind indulging.
No, go for it, dude.
So yeah, when Tokyo was chosen to host the 2020 Summer Olympics in the 2013 bidding process, several commentators claimed that Akira had predicted that. In 2017, Akira was referred to in several Tokyo Olympic promotions, and in February 2020, during the coronavirus pandemic and 147 days before the Olympics, the scene in Akira which calls for the cancellation of the 2020 Olympics 147 days before the event led to a social media trend calling for the cancellation of the 2020 Olympics. The Summer Olympics were, of course, eventually postponed to 2021 due to the COVID pandemic, which is just like, what are the odds that that would be like life imitating art in that way?
I did not know that. That is
I didn't either. I read about it and I was like, I missed that social media trend and everything.
That
but
is
like,
fantastic.
Yeah.
So yeah, so what about you, Rick? What is it about this that just gets to you?
Oh, it's just bloody brilliant, isn't it? I mean, like Mike, I'm a massive sort of like SF geek. You know, I'm quite visually oriented. I'm a massive fan of comics, full stop. Whether they're got science fiction things, whether it's manga or it's Western comics or European comics, I just love them. But it is a visual feast on your eyes, and it just sort of like all that color and all that aspects of those technicalities just embed themselves into your brain because of it. I mean, as we've been talking and we've been discussing it and you've been mentioning sequences and scenes, they're all just coming back into my head, like, and I can just replay them back in my head. I don't have to watch the DVD, I can just replay them back in my head and see.
Yeah,
I mean, the bit that you were talking about, the skiff, the flyer in the elevator, that's already in my head, and I've even got the music going on in it. So you know, it does make sense as a film. It's a complete film, beginning, middle, and end. But you can see where they were trying to go to with it for the future. But it is just a nice, complete story about lots of many different things. And I think it handles all those really well. Yeah, possibly some bits maybe could have been handled a bit better than others. Yeah, Kaneda's friendship with his friend trying to get him back to, you know, sort of like to bring him back.
Look, he's our friend. If anyone's going to kill him, it's going to be us.
Well, yeah, you know, but that's what it comes down to. You know, he's my friend. You know, and in our, yeah, you can imagine him thinking if this was reversed, he'd be doing the same for me.
Yeah.
So
there are a couple of times though when he gets like uber mean to him, and I'm just like, dude, is this actually your friend?
Yeah. they're both like, if I remember, they're both in the orphans, so they grew up in an orphanage, yeah. And dude, you know, Kaneda is obviously the tougher of the two,
yeah,
sort of like mentally and physically, and even though he acts like an elder brother to Tetsuo. Yeah, I think in a lot of respects with that. But yeah, even if you have an elder brother or if you have a younger brother, you're still going to josh them and give them a bit of a hard time because you can.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
you know, I think there's a lot there as well. But yeah, no, it's just like a stunning piece of work. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of those animation choices, to me, they're beautiful. I mean, even if what they're conveying, you know, isn't beautiful. But I'm just going to say to you, Mike, you're saying, oh, he's supposed to be his friend, he's mean. Have you ever read back our messenger chats? I mean, Jesus, dude.
At no point have I ever been like, you think you've got power, DK. You are the lord of nothing. You are just scrap metal, boy.
Mate, just hope I don't turn up on your front doorstep on a bike and a laser cannon. So what about you, Toby? What is it that does it for you on this one?
Two things, actually. The first one was already mentioned. It's just visually so stunning to watch, front to back, but especially the beginning sequence is just so good to watch. And what I also really enjoyed is in the first half, where we have a lot of delinquent style anime, a lot of a good delinquent story, and this aspect was really fun to me to just see that. I love everything delinquent, urban stories, all of that is just one of my favorites, and that was cool to see in the first half. Obviously, in the second half, it goes into a different direction. That's also cool, not to discount that, but that was just one thing where I was like, oh, it's doing that. That's really cool. I like that.
Cool. So, yeah, some good answers there. I mean, it's always interesting to me just what does it for people watching these things. So, thanks for that, guys. So, yeah, that's what we think. But how about you out there? Well, we're going to once more go over to hear your thoughts. And for that, we're going to return to the good Lady Vianne. You heard her last month, or maybe not, depending on the viewing figures, on Ghostbusters. And she did such an awesome job. She's kindly agreed to come back. So, yeah, without further ado, Vianne, what do you have for us this month?
Vianne! Hey, DK. So, I personally don't have much to report on this movie. The only thing I really know about Akira is the Akira slide, which I only know because it was referenced in Jordan Peele's masterpiece, Nope. So when I was, you know, kind of researching that movie and some of the references in it, I found out about that. But let's see. Have you seen Akira, and what would you rate it out of 5 stars? JB Hajim, when it came out, I gave it an 8. Now it is more like a 6. The storytelling is on the weaker side, as is the edit pacing. But I guess if we're talking 6 out of 5, that's good. But it looks like he might be going at out of 10 stars. Robert Lunt, 4 stars. Monty Adkins, when I originally saw it, I thought it was overrated aside from the animation. Perhaps I should give it another go. So somebody's due for a revisit. Fuji Hoffman, 7 out of 5 stars. So somebody loved it. Tony Louis Simon, 5.5. Great movie, compelling story, unique animation by today's standards, let alone the time it came out. Has influenced more current animation than people would imagine. Has great rewatchability, unlike a lot of current media. Can confirm that. I agree. So much current media has no rewatch potential. So that's a great thing to point out about, you know, any film, I think. But Robert John Turner, Akira was the first manga I ever watched, and I tried watching other manga, and nothing at the time measured up. So it kind of killed my love for the genre before it began. I have an awesome Akira Throne Priest from McFarlane. Robert Lunt again, it's mad and lovely all at the same time. Faint praise indeed. George F. Riach Fasundo, I hope I'm saying that right. Unequal Perfection, Jeff James, I guess you probably pronounce that. 5 stars, cannot be matched. You know, people really do seem to like this film, so maybe I'm going to have to give it a watch. I'm not a big manga person myself or anime person, but, you know, there's always potential there. So, you know, something I'm going to have to check out, but it does look like it has a pretty strong following. So with that, back to you, DK.
Yeah, thanks for that, Vianne. We'll hopefully see you next time. Again, thank you to all of you who wrote in to give us your opinions. And if you're a little late to the party, then don't worry. We're always open to hearing what you have to say. Just drop us a line in the comments section or the socials and let us know what you think. Which brings us, inevitably, to our final thoughts and conclusions on this one. And if you're a regular listener to Silver Screen, you'll know that we ask our guests not only for their summation, but a score out of 5. So with that in mind, we're going to come over to you first, Toby. What are your final thoughts and score out of 5 on Akira?
The setup. oh, great. I always forget to write something down.
Do you want me to come back to you?
No, I try.
All right.
I mean, the things that stand out is the visuals. For me, as I said, the visuals really stand out. It's amazing for that time period, but also now. I really like the story. It's very straightforward. As I mentioned, it doesn't really get into any too complicated territories. Like, okay, it gets into that in the end. But for the most part, I think it's good to follow. And that's, I think, really important. And I think a lot of futuristic stories just lose that, I think. They get too much into their own cleverness and twists and all of that. And it does tell a really good story, just pretty straightforward for the most time. Gets a little bit into that at the back end. But I think that's okay because, as we said, it's take over like 10 minutes or what is it? Like, that's fine. You can do a little bit of that towards the end. I love the characters. They were really fun. I don't know. That's it. I needed to give a score. I'm not sure if it's a 5. 4.5. I don't know. It was just missing the something for the 5 for me. I don't know.
That's fair enough. What about you, Rick?
I think if you're going to give some, even now, after all these years, if you want to introduce somebody who may be a fan of animation or a fan of films or science fiction who may have not seen it, if you want to give somebody the best example or one of the best examples of hand-drawn animation from Japan, you show them Akira. It encompasses everything that should be or could be or would be in an excellent film, I think, as an example of a craft, you know, of a piece of work. I think it sums everything up perfectly. You know, it is just an exceptionally good film. I probably wouldn't give it a 5 either. I have watched other things that I, you know, that are for me personally a little bit more, you know, sort of like, you know, even if they're technically not as well animated or not well as well created, there's just something that resonates with me a bit more than, say, Akira does. But I would probably call it not a 4.5, but a 4.8 or a 4.9. It's very close.
What would you like to go with?
I'll go for a 4.8.
A 4.8?
Yeah.
No worries. I'm
not sure it makes much difference, but yeah.
Well, you never know. What about you, Mike? Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go, or what would you prefer?
I'll go if you want, it's a bit long, sorry, I tend to get that way with me. I'd say a truly groundbreaking and hugely influential movie. It's no wonder it opened up the eyes of the world to Japanese anime, proved that animation for adults is a real thing, and inspired multiple future generations of creatives. This thing still looks absolutely gorgeous. The attention to detail, the pioneering little techniques and technical touches, or even just the iconic imagery that's become ingrained into popular culture. But it's not all flash and no substance. The plot explores some really deep philosophical and real-world questions that make this a truly top-tier science fiction movie, animated or otherwise. For me, though, the violence and gore crosses the line into gratuitous a few times, and the body horror ending is just too bizarre for my taste, feeling like a bit of a tonally jarring misstep for me. I also do dislike the killing of Kaori and rescue of the Colonel, though I recognise that's likely one of the many themes at play, that it's unrealistic to choose who lives and dies, and doing so would be playing God, the dangers of which are made all too apparent. Not perfect then, but honestly very close. I love 99% of this, and I do think it deserves its reputation. So see it now before the inevitable Hollywood remake misses the point of everything here and ruins it. And I'll go with 4.6 out of 5, I'm going to say for that.
Okay, 4.6. Nice. All right. So I'm going to say, I mean, it's been a good while since I watched this, so much in fact that the last time I did so, I watched a completely different dub. However, this thing hasn't lost its power or emotion in those intervening years. The story's solid, the animation still looks good, the performances are great, if a little jarring for me personally, and it still holds up. It was pioneering, and you can still see its influence in countless anime that followed, even though, you know, as I mentioned earlier, some may have taken the wrong lessons, along with novels, video games, and the genre itself. So many projects since owe their look and style to Akira. It's a classic, and for damn good reasons. And I've also given it 4.5, which, taking everyone's score into account, means that Akira receives a final cult classic score of 4.6 out of 5.
I called it.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think that's fair. What about you guys?
I'll go with that.
Nice one. So, yeah, that's it for this episode. As per the norm, all that's left to do is to thank my guests on the show today for making it such an interesting one. So, as always, thanks for backing me up on this one today, mate.
Oh, you're welcome.
Nice one. Enjoyed it?
Yeah, I have actually. I enjoyed watching it, and it's good to talk about it with people that, as you say, share similar opinions. So that's all good.
Cool. So same place as always, people can find you, link in the description, or is there anything else you want to draw attention to this time?
No, it'll be on screen because I'm doing the edit, so I'll chuck it up, although I have given it to Nick for future edits of this as well. If you're listening, like I said, I'll try and rattle through it quickly. We are Silver Screen Podcast on YouTube, or Silver Screen Podcast / Hit or Miss Star Trek Podcast on Spotify or audio platforms, Silver Screen Podcast Facebook group, Silver Screen Podcast, all one word, on Instagram, at Silver Screen Pod, at mstdn.social on Mastodon. We are my personal one, michael.k.wilson on Threads, at mikepods.bsky.social on Blue Sky, and we're at Trek Screen Pods as long as Twitter is surviving, with a capital T as in P.
Nice one. And I'm nowhere. Over to you, Toby. Thank you for finally coming on a cult classic. How was it for you?
It was great, finally being here. I'm usually just with Mike and someone else doing Marvel stuff, so like, we're doing something else. That's great.
Nice.
Not that I hate Marvel stuff, but we need variety.
Is there anything you'd like to draw attention to while you're here? Any upcoming projects or social media the listeners can find you on?
I hope that by now my YouTube would be ready. It's not, those who know, know. But I can link my Blue Sky, because it makes sense here, because I talk about anime and manga there and nothing else. So I never plugged it because I'm like, nobody cares. But the people that watch this might care. It's Dark Sonic. That's it. Dark Sonic.
Cool. That's fair enough. And finally, thank you to Rick for subjecting yourself to this thing for the first time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
No problem. How was it? Up for a return visit at some point? Or have you made you never want to do one of these things again?
I'm not averse to coming back after I've had a lay down and a cup of tea. I think I can probably manage that, depending on subject matter.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, as with everyone else, do you have anything you'd like to draw attention to while you're here? Where can listeners find you, should they be so inclined?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I've got much. Yeah, I'm not sort of like an influencer-y type person or anything like that. I just potter along and do my own thing. You might be able to find me on Facebook at Howling Mad Cowling Fandom Page. And on sort of like, I have a page on Facebook for where I go and share geeky, nerdy things and a lot of my cosplay photography when I go to conventions, which has been a bit infrequent recently, I admit. But I think that's probably about it.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't really do much. I'm sort of potter around at home helping my wife run our business. So, yeah.
what business is that?
Oh, it's we run a craft store, an online craft shop called Seven Hills Crafts. .co.uk, I'll put that bit in. And we do sort of like, you know, arts and crafts materials for people and stuff, and we send them out from a little house in Sheffield. Yeah.
Nice one. I'll definitely put a link to that in the
description
as well,
man. We'll get them in the description for today's show. So, yeah, you out there, if you're inclined, please do check them out, as well as our Ko-fi account. Any help to keep these shows running is gratefully received. You know, as always, we don't do this because it's easy. We do it because we thought it would be easy. Now, if you enjoyed today's episode and want to hear more, then please like and subscribe. And if you have any movie lover friends, please invite them along. We're getting quite the archive of movie reviews now, so feel free to check them out. I'm sure there'll be something among them to pique your interest on the Silver Screen channel. And our social media accounts are always open. Now, we'll be staying in Japan for next month's episode, albeit from a different time period. I'll be joined by the Kaiju Whisperer himself as we take a look at the 1966 monster movie War of the Gargantuas. So if that's a favourite of yours, or if you're just intrigued, come pull up a bar stool as we look at that underrated classic. First Tuesday of next month, be there. Until then, take care out there, cultists, and we'll be here for you next time, because remember, it has already begun.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by TK, produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.